Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
The Marines have a saying, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. The center of bringing any dream into fruition is self-discipline.
G'day everyone, welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. It's our usual Friday wrap. Good to have Jazz back this week, by the way, after missing 2 weeks. Jazz, you've gone to your planet Discovery and didn't want to join us anymore.
Yeah, no, John has been making me work hard to find gold, so I've been looking all around. I have found so much gold that the price won't move up anymore. Hey, John.
It's too much gold on the moon.
That's why John's gold is currently sinking at the moment, isn't it? So he's creating much more supply than there's demand. So
you make me sound like a Bond villain. John's gold. I've got a cat here without any fur. And
well, I thought you were going to take it out at some point and show it to the audience. So we're still waiting for that magical moment. But how are you, John? Welcome back to the show.
I'm good. I've just been eating popcorn and watching TV for the last 2 weeks. Election coverage is very interesting. Oh, no, I'm great. I'm doing great.
Which channel? CNBC? CNN?
All of the above.
All of the above. Yeah, all right. But it's good to have all the crew back, mate. I think, after 2 weeks, John and I just been holding the fort. It's obviously good to welcome Jazz back from Moon and join us back again with a new hairstyle too, by the way, which unfortunately most of the audiences can't see. But I think we can't talk about the news this week without touching on the election, just like what John has actually rightly pointed out. It is an interesting 2020, and we've been saying this for a few weeks. 2020 still got something before end of the year, right? That's going to give us that curveball. And I think we are actually seeing that right now. Despite the fact that the election result has been officially published and announced, there's still a lot of argy-bargy around the election results, especially from Trump administration, which they just refuse to concede defeat in the current environment. And, I think this morning there's been news talking about that they need to stop this circus, inverted commas, circus show, in a sense. So, but gents, I'll welcome your thoughts at the moment. I haven't been following as closely as I should be. Maybe, John, I reckon, what about you? You've been following it closely. Give us a bit of lead-in.
You're picking on me now. I'm a bit of a political junkie, and I know whatever I say, I'm going to alienate 49% of the listeners here. But
the idea is to have you start off, and then Jazz can basically refute whatever.
That's right. Have your finger hovering over the edit button as we go. So, I think, what are we, 2 weeks away, or we're a week and a half since the election? The way it sort of played out was the in-booth voting went decisively to Trump, and then the ballots that came in via mail overnight went decisively to Biden. And my view is that Trump is right to be questioning this. There have been elections that have been queried in the past, that's normal, but this is the first time you've had en masse mail-in votes. And there was a lot of speculation before the election, including on this podcast, that it's a more vulnerable way of voting in terms of fraud. So a lot of people from voting booths have signed sworn affidavits that there was electoral fraud. I think there are up to about 4,000 people are saying that there was electoral fraud, and an affidavit is a sworn document. So we'll see how that plays out. I'm totally fine with this being challenged. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. If he's wrong, he'll look silly. If he's right, then, kind of justice will have been done. That's kind of how I read it. So, you know, the Biden supporters who are suggesting that he shouldn't be challenging it, it's a bit weird. Like, there's no reason why he shouldn't let the courts decide. And if he's wrong, he will look silly, and then everyone wins. At the moment, there's a hand-by-hand manual recount in Georgia. But what's really interesting is what's happening in Pennsylvania. So if he swings Pennsylvania, he might be able to win the election. And I think maybe, you know, David, you talked about a twist. The twist might be that the election swings back to Trump. So the way it could work for Trump, the path to victory for Trump, So I'm speaking to 49% of the listeners out there, I think, and I'm alienating everyone else. But here's how Trump wins, right? And there was a bit of a green light this morning on this. But the Pennsylvania courts decided in the weeks leading up to the election that they can accept votes after Election Day. Now, the reason conservatives are getting upset about this is because it's election day, not election season or election month. And the reason it's election day is because if you have people voting for too long a period of time, you get a lot of fraud. And so when the Pennsylvania court decided a couple of weeks before the election that they would allow votes to come in after election day, and in fact, votes that have been signed after election day, that's what led to all this absentee voting. Now, the Constitution in the US is very specific about what Election Day is. Election Day is the first Tuesday of the month in November or something like that, or the second Tuesday. Now, with the Pennsylvania court saying that they will accept votes date stamped after the election for 3 days, they have essentially changed Election Day, and that's unconstitutional. Now, that means he can swing 700,000 votes back to Trump in Pennsylvania. And that's the path to potential victory. Now, then he's got a couple of other states, but he could definitely pull Pennsylvania back. And that's, I think that's about 17 Electoral College votes. That changes everything. So that's kind of the nuts and bolts of it. I'll go through some other things, but I want to throw back to you guys first. Thoughts on that?
Doesn't that lead to a risk of kind of a riots or civil war within the country?
100%. This leads to another part of what's been going on. The media decided that Biden won. The media called it. This is a really interesting thing. And in addition to the media calling it, I suppose I don't have a huge problem with it as long as it's an informal calling, but they've been calling him the president-elect. Now, he's not the president-elect until the Electoral College vote, and that's on about the 10th of December, after which they can call him the president-elect up until inauguration date. But they're calling him president-elect, and Biden's calling the Pope and all the, you know, foreign leaders are congratulating him. It's really inappropriate. They should just let it play out. When Gore challenged the election back in 2000, he was given 3 weeks. So just let it play out. I'm sure, you know, again, if Trump's right, then justice will have been done. And if Trump's wrong, he'll look silly.
You know, the other thing that I find interesting, John and David, is the Pfizer medicine got announced straight after the election results. It's like they always knew about the outcome of the testing that they were doing with the medicine, but they were holding on to the election. And Trump has been saying that all this time that medicine will be announced soon, before the end of the year. I don't know how much of that if there's any card that he'll pull out on that as well.
I mean, it's, for me, it's highly suspicious. You know, Jazz, you're sitting there with what looks like a Roger Federer bandana, but you could be wearing a tinfoil hat for you know, with a comment like that. No, I agree. Like, I remember when I was watching some late night news when it got announced, and I just look over the table at my wife and kind of tilt my head and roll my eyes like, the vaccine comes out. Of course it does. It stacks up. It leads to paranoia and conspiracy theories from that Trump team that said that the whole deck was stacked against him. It was from, you know, every media outlet. There's a lot of criticism of Fox News at the moment, which is supposed to be conservative. There's, you know, from the media to professional sports to big tech, you know, anytime there was a Trump tweet, Twitter would take it down. My view is I still think that Biden will probably win. However, I think when we're talking about the election in 10 years' time, this will be the election that broke up the Silicon Valley social media big titans. Because I think that people on that Trump side of the aisle are going to tune out of Twitter and Facebook and all those kind of guys that just totally manipulated the election.
Mm-hmm. Isn't Biden going to be also like putting some regulations or more regulations towards these social media companies moving forward as well, in terms of what kind of statements can be made, what can't be made, and that kind of stuff? I think he's going to put more rules and regulations around it, from memory.
Yeah, potentially. So it depends on what. Let's take Facebook, for example, or let's take Twitter. Is Twitter a platform or are they an editor? Now, they have all the protections of a platform. It's like AT&T or Telstra. No one jumps on the phone and says, we don't like what you're saying. They're just a platform, and Telstra's not responsible for what's said on the phone lines that they provide. Now, Twitter gets the same protection as though they are just a platform. But if Twitter's taking stuff off that's, let's face it, it's just political speech, That's all it is. If they're taking political speech down, are they a platform? And I think that'll be the debate over the next 4 years.
Yeah, that is the interesting question there. I think that's for sure. So, but I totally agree. I think if there is a, it seems like the whole election results going into more of a chaos and anarchy type of states. You know, that's what's really worrying for every world leader, given the fact that COVID-19 is still a huge issue, especially around Europe and US. You know, it's not nowhere near being anywhere being controlled at the moment. And, you know, people are calling for stability, you know. Yes, it's important to make sure that the election result does get obviously worked through and all the counts and the leaders who, you know, you basically need to start focusing on the real crux of the issues now that, you know, the election outcome has kind of like, you know, get to a point where it's more of a stable state, right? You know, so put your emphasis on clearing out or working through the COVID status rather than having to continue to work out, well, what's going on here? Because there's only limited resources that people have, right? If you divert all that resources towards what they call this inverted commas circus, then... there'll be a lot more people suffering in US and in Europe and et cetera, et cetera. So there's two ways of looking at it, basically. I have to start questioning whether there's obviously, you know, a lot of conspiracy theories. I'm not saying that there won't be and there could be, but you know, a lot of evidence from what you're telling us at the moment, John, is saying yes, there could be something that's behind the scenes, of course, and people are working for it. But at the same time, you know, the political leaders need to take responsibility to make sure that the American people are being looked after, rather than putting their, their political interest in front of everything else. It's just my gut feeling, mate. So my thoughts.
You know, I was listening to another podcast the other day, an American one, and they were saying, in 1980, there were 300 seats, I suppose, or counties that were what they call a landslide county, which means fully Democrat or fully Republican, 300. In 2020, it's 1,700. So the nation is extremely divided. In every county, they're either extremely red or extremely blue, but, you know, they're becoming less and less purple. And this is why when... You know, they talk about the popular vote, the majority vote. It's not so relevant because the popular vote will go to whoever California and New York decide to vote for, which is often a Democrat. But the nation is extremely divided, and each community is very red or very blue. And it's, I mean, how do you coexist when you don't share the values of people? You know. One state away. It's very dangerous. I agree with you, David. You sort of raised it a couple of times about where does this go from a violence perspective? We don't seem to be able to talk to each other. It's interesting times. Mm-hmm. I mean, the American system is very resilient. It's actually designed for this, but you wonder how long it can last, I suppose.
The next one that we want to touch on then is about this vaccine from Pfizer. So again, some interesting topics here. We are still seeing, I think, it's still a bit away at the moment from the actual vaccine being released, but certainly the preliminary testing so far has shown positive results, and that has been reflected on the market, both Australia and US and obviously across the states. And I think the day that the vaccine was announced, I think the Zoom stock actually had, 90% fall in stock price or something. So the tech stock are basically taking a massive hit, whereas the aviation, the hospitality tourism side of stocks has now started rebounding, and they're saying that was going to be the bottom, essentially, from what we're seeing. So, but is this vaccine really the solution to everything? And, you know, like, should we keep a bit of skepticism at the moment, given the fact that it's kind of still early days? You know, they're saying what, publicly released around quarter three in 2021. Is that right, guys?
Yeah.
So, what are your thoughts? Do you guys think that is this some sort of manipulation? Because I think John just before pre-air was saying that the CEO of the Pfizer actually sold what 60% of his shares the next day after such announcements, right? So, and took a huge profit from it. You got to wonder whether there's another message behind the scenes, or you know what, why would he do such if the vaccine is definitely on the right track of, and you know. What are your thoughts?
I mean, it was a big announcement of the day. It's sort of come back a little bit. Pfizer rose 15% on the day, and Pfizer's one of the biggest companies on the exchanges over there. The Dow futures were up 1,600, or about 4%, yep. And it closed about half of that, so it was still well up. But David, exactly as you said, what happened was the whole stock market started rotating back to old names, so it rotated out of the Zooms, out of the tech stocks, into bricks and mortar and airlines and those sorts of things. So what do I think of the vaccine? I'm prepared to believe that it was 90% effective in the sample size that it tested. The question is, how did they pick the sample? What I've heard is that the sample size wasn't very big, or not as big as normal vaccine testing. It's I think it's the fastest vaccine to ever be produced, and by contrast, the mumps, you know, 70 years ago took 4 years, and this has taken about 9 months. It's been very quick, but I'm happy to believe it works. One thing that we know about the vaccine is that it is very fragile, so it only works at it's only effective at minus 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So if anyone's got a calculator, they can convert that to Celsius. But most vaccines work at minus 4%, 4 degrees. So it works at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. Most work at minus 4 degrees. So it's very difficult to transport around. So I'm happy to believe it works, but I don't know how practical it is to start distributing en masse. But we'll see. I mean, David, you hit the nail on the head, though. The CEO of Pfizer sold 60% of his stock later that day or the next day. And the question is why. He claims that he declared this back in August, that he was going to do this. So maybe it's okay. But in 2020, I'm prepared to believe anything.
I think, John, it was you who said that anything that happens in the political year has always got more to it. So this news clearly, it's pretty obvious. I mean, that cards were laid against the Trump in this case. To me, it feels like, I don't have any proof, but this is just my personal gut that I'm talking over here over the podcast, that the medicine gets announced a week later after the election results. Obviously, they knew the vaccine test results way before. It was just not being announced, which fully gathered why you want to do that. But at the same time, the CEO of a company dumping the stock tells you something. And it's clearly being reflected in the stocks, some of the good stocks like Sydney Airport, which on this podcast has been discussed a few times. That's up by about 30-40% now.
Yeah. Well on its way to recovery, basically, isn't it? Yeah. So,
I'm really happy that there's a vaccine out there. I don't want to be made to take it, but I'm really happy that it exists and people can make up their own mind. The only thing that scares me, and this comes back to Jazz's tinfoil hat / Roger Federer bandana, is that there is a lot of talk, and I think that some MPs in Victoria talked about this, which is, you know, if you don't take the vaccine, then you'll be blocked from certain things like air travel or welfare payments. So that's when I start to get nervous. But if there's a vaccine, I think that's a great thing. If it starts to infringe on my liberty, then it's a bad thing. Then it becomes coercive.
I think they're making it compulsory in Australia for everyone to take it. Is that correct? From memory? No?
Don't like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that was something that I read, but again, I'm not 100% sure. So
let's get used to it. There will be soon chips planted in us as well, just to track COVID, basically.
Well, you know what they'll do? They'll make it compulsory, but not compulsory. So they'll say, it's not compulsory, but good luck getting on a plane, or good luck enrolling.
It's compulsory.
Basically forcing you in a different way to say you've got to take it, otherwise you can do nothing.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not compulsory. You just can't do anything if you don't.
You cannot cross national borders if you don't have the vaccine, basically.
Yeah.
I think we are really, it's a privacy thing, right? So we are really headed down the path of where we'll be forced onto some things that a lot of people won't like, but they don't have a choice either. Like electronic bracelets that they're talking about when you get out of the airport, there's a talk about that. Won't be surprising if there's something more permanent that's implanted in us in 5 years' time. But anyways, that's more of...
Jazz is getting his tech talks again.
I think one day we should talk about, and I think I might be drawing too long a bow here, but, you know, is this kind of the end? Is this what it looked like when Rome started to crumble? You know, they gave away a few liberties. They started over diluting the value of their currency and so on for another time, I think.
Could do a stark contrast, you know, back in comparison with the Roman Empire back in the day. So that would be an interesting topic. Okay. Good. Throw it out there. All right. Gents, I think we talked enough about politics and the vaccine this time. I reckon that circle back to property, which is kind of where we all have our true passions are. All of a sudden, I thought, well, I was actually in another political podcast. Anyway, so an interesting stat this week, which I think, Jazz, you've actually posted with us, net immigration to Australia has been negative for the first time since 1976. I think we're looking at around negative 40 to 80 at the moment. Now, we know that the property prices needs the immigrants to come in. And obviously looking at the trends, it's not anywhere near the level that we wanted it to be. And that's understandable because the borders still remain closed. Mm-hmm. Now, hopefully in the next few months, with a bit of confidence, Scott Morrison's going to open up the borders and, you know, there'll be more immigrants coming in, more students coming in 2021. But how would this negative net immigration, which obviously take a while, you know, like we're always, this is more of a lagging indicator, of course. Mm-hmm. So the property prices that we're seeing right now across on the ground, you know, I think last month we're looking at October, all capital cities are now in positive territories, I think, except Melbourne, probably a minus 0.2, but it's negligible. So all capital cities are pretty much in the positive territory. People are fighting on the ground pretty hard in terms of getting a property. Yet this net immigration is negative. So, you know, how do we actually equate that?
In my opinion, the first thing is, again, going back to the vaccine that we were just talking about, it's not going to get commercialized up until late 2021. And if that statement holds true, that means is basically... the net immigration is still going to be low negative numbers or low positive numbers, which means let's just call it zero immigration, more or less.
Okay.
And so if that's the case, two of the biggest factors that drive the property prices is your interest rates, which is in the favor of property at the moment, and the other is the net immigration, right? So, we are 50% there, but I think the real pickup that we'll see in the property prices, which is what when all the articles will start calling boom bust stories, I think will be more in late 2021, 22 kind of thing when the whole vaccine situation is cleared, airports are back to normal. So there is no COVID normal, it's normal life essentially. To me, that's the big thing here. I don't know, what do you guys think?
I totally agree with you. I think at the moment, it's more of a inflated because of the low interest rate, right? That's the only thing that's kind of making everyone try to carry. And like I alluded before as well, the responsible lending obligation is in the path of getting scraped, and we're looking at a March 2021 on that. That's also because I guess the government and the Treasury has already foreseen that they understand the net immigration is low and will remain to be low for majority part of 2021. So they need something else to stimulate that property market. So, you know, the speed of credit is obviously a very important factor to make sure that the property prices remain as is and strong, and also all the incentives that's been thrown out to first home buyers to make sure they're still holding the market. As a matter of fact, the investors are starting to come back into the market as well. I've got a few investor clients that's obviously looking outside Sydney and Melbourne to a degree. They're more looking at, you know, the Brisbane's, the Adelaide's, the ones that with decent rental yield to a degree. But investor market are coming back, and I'm sure the stats will show that as well. So they're looking at alternatives to support that the property prices, and excluding net immigration in the short and near term. That's the way I look at it. But yeah, once the net immigration has gone full swing again, just like what we were pre-COVID, obviously there's going to be a lot of demand from that point onwards. So, John, what do you reckon?
Well, I think the Australian property market relies on and desperately needs migration. You know, we're not seeing it in the prices because prices are basically going up at the moment, and that's because prices are interest rate sensitive, but rents are not interest rate sensitive. So what we're seeing is really high vacancy rates, and that's a that's a reflection of the low net immigration. When, you know, when people go to a new country, they initially rent for the first couple of years and then they buy down the track. So we're seeing very high vacancy rates precisely because there's low net migration. And if you look at the two big migration cities, which is Sydney and Melbourne, particularly Melbourne, I think you can make an argument for the vacancy rates for units is 7% or over 7%. It's about 5% for Sydney, and it's about 3% for Brisbane. So the migration's popping up in rentals. One last thing to say, and I don't want to bring politics back into it, but I wanted to pose a question about the movement of net migration. So, you know, migration is generally the movement of migration is generally from authoritarian countries to more free countries, but the West isn't very free. If you look at COVID, we're far more authoritarian than a lot of the places where these people are leaving. So if you're moving towards civil liberties, is the West the place for you? Is Australia the right place? Would you go to Victoria if you're seeking a freer life and more economic opportunity? I think it's telling us other things about the desirability of our countries. And I think Australia is very desirable because it's safe and prosperous, but it's becoming quite authoritarian.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, John, and I kind of agree with you on that, except that if you think about the developing world, whether it's in, let's not name any country, but basically developing world, right? They'll care a little less about the more authoritarian regimes where if they get the opportunity to be in a country like Australia still, I mean, for the people living here, it may be horrendous of what's happened in the last couple of months, especially in Victoria. But for the people who are living in the developing world where there's a lot of other challenges, they'll still look at overall as a net positive, not a net negative. So, because there's a lot of other positive, whether it's the weather or whether it's the job opportunities, hoping that those things, for those people, those kind of things don't matter, basically. What happened in Victoria or other parts of the Western world is how I look at it. It's very
good point. Yeah. Good point. I mean, that takes a long time to change.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's still a most livable city. For maybe a year or two, it won't be. It will still come back on the charts at some point.
Yeah, good point. That actually leads to another interesting question I have in mind, which I'll throw it out here for both of you. We're obviously seeing a surge in the lifestyle suburb property prices, you know, that's outside the capital cities that we're seeing. But is this trend sustainable in the long run? Are we seeing this working from home arrangement going to be a long term, say, you know, maybe 3 and 5 years' time? If we assume for a sec that, you're in 2025 at the moment in November, do you think that, you know, these lifestyle suburbs will continue to grow like they currently are and the trend is not going to slow? Or are we going to see it dying down and people moving back into capital cities?
It's funny you mentioned that, David, because I read an article, I think, yesterday, and I didn't do much deep dive into it. But it was NAB or one of the other banks who were trying to figure out with the politicians on when can people really go back to being in the office. Now, yeah. So basically, they still want their employees in the office for whatever, companies still want their employees in the office for whatever reason, right? But I think what will end up happening is for at least, I think there's a trend shift here, but it won't be working from home 5 days a week because that kills the some of the other important things such as socializing with your work colleagues and coming up with better ideas to
collaborations, isn't it?
Collaboration, essentially, right?
Yeah, so that's collaborations.
For it, right? So I don't think it's going to die down completely, but the trend shift will still be there to some extent to see change or the
pre-change.
Because if you have to only go to work once or twice a week or fortnight, then people can manage that much traveling. If you have to do that every day, I think that's a challenge. And I think that's the thing which companies are now trying to figure out, what's the new normal here. With tech companies, it's totally different. They can work remotely, not a problem. Doesn't matter which part of the world you're in. But with the more less tech companies, but every company is becoming a tech company to some extent, even a bank, right? There's a balancing that's required where you want to have that collaboration, but at the same time, you don't want your employees unnecessarily in the office when you can clearly see a productivity improvement during this COVID period, in my opinion.
Okay, so you're basically an advocate to say this is probably going to be a semi-permanent change. So, you know, the property prices in lifestyle suburbs are not likely to come down because there will still be long-term demand. But in the long run, they will find a balance, basically.
Correct. In fact, if anything, I'll say the trend will be more towards the property prices will more rise in the regional and the
lifestyle areas.
Lifestyle areas compared to the inner ring areas, which in the past was the opposite.
John, I know you're an advocate of inner city suburbs. We've got an opposing opinion here. What would you say?
Middle ring. my answer is that I don't really know. I think this is such a big shift. What I would say is that it's not as easy to move to regional as we're kind of suggesting. And the reason for that is the businesses are still in the city, the customers are still in the cities, the schools are still in the city, the sports clubs are still in the cities, the entertainment's still in the cities. So I hear you, and I think that there's less need to be in an office space. I totally agree. That's kind of permanent. I don't know what it means in terms of frequency, 1 day, 2 day, 5 days. But all of the social interaction still occurs within the cities. And to move that and to shift that into regional areas, I'm sure will happen. And I don't doubt it. It is happening. But there's a lot of infrastructure you need to move there as well. Like, where do the kids go to school? So what I suspect will happen is that older people or wealthy people will be able to move into these sea change or tree change suburbs. But I think the middle class will still have to stay in the cities. And I could be completely wrong on all of that. It's too big a shift for me to comprehend. But yeah, that's what I think.
I know the government's always pushing to decentralize, right? Because they're saying, look, it's too condensed around Sydney, it's too condensed around Melbourne. And they've always been pushing people and incentivizing people to actually move to more of a regional area and fill up those regional opportunities and stuff. So, you know, if done well, this could be a good way of getting all the infrastructure set up correctly and make sure this decentralization actually continues so that, you know, people can actually live. So, yes.
When you say decentralization, there's only one thing that comes to mind, Bitcoin, but not going there. we won't go there. Just to add to John's point, I think the other areas that will outperform the inner and the inner ring, more like the apartments and the inner CBD areas, is the outer suburbs, basically, which is what John was saying. Yes, not everybody can afford sea change areas because obviously the property prices generally are a little bit more expensive, but there will clearly be a trend shift otherwise. And we have discussed that in the past as well, where the outer suburbs that are 40 Ks out, where the property prices are a little bit more cheaper than the inner ring, I don't think people would want that kind of heavy mortgages, in my opinion, where you have to shell out $1 million for a tiny house or apartment when you can buy something 40 Ks out, essentially. Especially after the COVID period where everyone wanted to be in a house, not an apartment or a unit.
Yeah. I was listening to Mark Faber is an economist. He's an old guy, old Swiss guy living in Thailand or something. And he was asked this exact question on this YouTube clip I was listening to yesterday. And he said, I'd move, but I'm too old to make new friends. So in your example, Jazz, moving out, it does mean starting all over again. So if you move 40 kilometres out, who's your circle?
Who's your new social circle and all that? Right?
They're these invisible barriers that I think will prevail.
That's a very interesting one. Maybe Zoom will be your new social circle.
The share price just dropped 20%. Okay. All right. That's good. I think there's a good few topics. Mindful of the time. John, do you want to touch on a few property updates for us?
Oh, look, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. So the property market is very steady. It seems to be in an uptrend. The clearance rates are very high. So if I look at Sydney, they had an increase in the number of properties that sold under auction, and the clearance rate was 78.4%. Melbourne was 73%, and there was a CoreLogic data that suggested that Melbourne prices bottomed on the 18th of October. So Melbourne seems to be in an upswing, and their clearance rates are up. Although their volumes are up too. Brisbane at 44.9% clearance rate, that bounces around. Adelaide at 87% clearance, and Canberra at 78% or 79%. So it's very bullish across the board. The one other thing I would just mention briefly is vacancy rates. So vacancy rates is where the pain is in the real estate market. But it's even more specific than that. It's actually the vacancy rates for units. So the vacancy rates for units are 5% in Sydney, 7% in Melbourne, 3% in Brisbane. But interestingly, the overall vacancy rate in Adelaide is 1%. In Canberra, it's 0.9%. Darwin, 1.1%. So those smaller cities are very tight. And my guess is rents are rising and prices are rising there. So, you know, I'm always a little bit Sydney-centric, and I apologise for that. But the smaller cities are doing very well. Real estate's going to do what real estate does for the rest of the year, but I can't see, unless there's a policy change, prices are rising. And we had an interest rate cut last week as well.
That's right. It's all very bullish in terms of indications. Yeah. Jazz, you got anything?
No, I think it would be really interesting now to watch Melbourne as well, because Sydney and Melbourne are the biggest markets.
Mm.
And although the auction numbers listed on the chart that we all are looking at, for Melbourne, the listed properties were 480. But generally, if I'm not wrong, they are in the vicinity of 800 to 1,000. But still at 480 in the very first few weeks is pretty 73% clearance rate. That really tells you the pent-up demand that's there.
Yeah.
And as people start preparing their properties for next few weeks, I think what there's another 3 or 4 weeks left before we wrap up the great 2020. It will be interesting to see. I think next year will be very interesting for both Sydney and Melbourne and Perth, which we've talked about. So keen to see.
2021 is going to be strong for real estate, or is this like, you know, the earthquake and the tsunami happens a couple of months later? Is there a tsunami coming? Or
I don't think there's any earthquake here. I think the tsunami will come, but that's more in the positive way, where the prices will really start to shoot up, but not up until the COVID normal completely disappears and the normal life is here. And that will be in the immigration numbers and all that we were just touched on before. So in my opinion, we will really start to see an uptick in prices towards end of 2021-22. That's where the real, you know, the sharp growth that we talk about, the last 20% of the growth happens, which all of a sudden the prices spike. I think we'll start to see that somewhere in 2022, in my opinion.
Sorry, another question. We've got to wrap up. If prices start to ramp up significantly, is the RBA going to intervene and pour cold water over the property market, or are they going to let it run hot?
That's a really, really good question, John. Are they going to let it run hot? I think it will run hot for a little while, purely because what can RBA do this time with the interest rates is pretty much nothing. They can't. They really cannot increase the interest rates. What will end up happening is intervention from APRA, like last time or something, where the lending standards will be tightened once again. Mm-hmm. But we'll see that when that 2016 or 2015, when the property prices started going crazy, that's when we'll see APRA intervening into the space. I don't think there's much for RBA now to do in this space. Raising interest rates is a problem. They in fact have gone the other way around for that, which we were right on the podcast for the last few weeks talking about it. So raising is not on the cards, and Fed Jerome Powell has said that as well. We're not even thinking about raising rates. Love that statement, by the way. the way he said that. So it's more the when the immigration starts to pick up and all, I think at some point there will be intervention from APRA, in my opinion. So yes, there will be controls put in place, but it will run hot for once. It's not like freaking running hot for 10 years. It's probably for a few months, we'll see a sharp spike.
Yeah, I think they'll control it, basically. I agree with you, Jazz. I think it's going to come from APRA intervention through lending and, you know, introducing like DTI, for example, even for first home buyers. You know, at the moment, I think their DTI is quite high, which allows them to borrow up to quite high, but you're already putting that in place for investors, which is why investors have a lot of restrictions right now. Mm-hmm. So that kind of indicators can easily confine, because, you know, if you can't get the lending, then you can't get the property, right? We all say that, we all know that finance is the bloodline of getting the property. So that's one way of one lever which they can tweak, and they've obviously shown that is very effective through APRA. So less from RBA's perspective, but and, you know, who knows, maybe Philip Lowe did promise to say like 3 years, the interest rates are not going to rise, but who knows? If things and indicators are going well in 2 years' time, he may have to break his own promise. He may have to raise the rate a little bit just to basically cool down a little bit, right? Cool the market down. So that's also on the card, not to say completely impossible. It just depends on the economic indicators at that point in time. So, but yeah, they're starting to run out of things that they can do. Basically. So.
And am I wrong in saying that, David, the assessment rates have been dropped as well now, isn't it?
Correct.
Some of the big four banks.
Yes.
That tells you that they really want the lending to start flowing into the economy, which means more property transactions, which means at some point when everything is clean, property prices will go up.
Nothing to add. I think that was great. I mean, so maybe one thing to add. When they turn the tap on and lending starts, the question for me is going to be, does business get any of that lending, or does it all go into real estate? Because businesses are on their knees, and if you're a lender, where do you want the money to go? I think you're going to want it to go into real estate. So I think that the real estate boom might happen bigger and sooner, because there's nowhere else for that credit to go and know that it's safe and you'll get a return. I think it's going to flood hard into real estate. And it's going to deprive businesses of credit. But we'll see.
I heard business lending is also on the recovery, though. So, you know, when we got more data coming out, we'll touch on it too. So
That's a very interesting point. The business lending, even though it's on recovery, Australia hasn't so far really favored business lending that much compared to residential lending, obviously. It will be good if that changes from our economy perspective. It will be awesome, actually, to see that happening where businesses thrive and survive. But even though loosening the standards in Australia is still relatively pretty tight for business owners to be able to borrow money, especially in this environment. So if it happens, awesome. But I think it's more favoring the property. It's just in the blood of Australians, basically.
the rest of Australian cities are doing businesses are obviously starting to recover. We're just waiting on Victorian counterparts to also be able to join the party. So hopefully in a few months' time, we'll have better news for everyone.
Mm. Just don't get too excited when the property prices go to start to go crazy a little bit before that happens late next year or the year after. Keep your lending in check. That's all I'll say.
That's it. Gents, that's good. That's good discussions. We'll probably call it a wrap this week. And, you know, thank you everyone for tuning in. As always, we appreciate your feedback. If you got any questions about what we discussed today, you can always reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com.au. We always welcome, 2021 just around the corner. We've also got some exciting stuff. We're planning about the format. We're thinking about how we can refine this Friday wrap even better. So we welcome any thoughts and ideas about what you like to listen to. Okay. So, all right. Until next week, we will see you guys again in another episode of Spark Your Fire. Jazz, John, and David.
Thanks.